Arthur Gomez will too. Yes, you were talking about the Thracian.
Yes, HMS Thracian, after doing excellent work in laying the mines and playing a major part in evacuating the British troops from Kowloon, from Devil's Peak, that fought a rearguard action and brought in many armaments and equipment from Kowloon, she was attacked by the Japanese planes. The Japanese used their air force and their army and their artillery to very good effect. The artillery were accurate, and the aircraft bombing also was accurate. We had no air force.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the air force. Okay. What air defences you had, Arthur?
The Royal Air Force in Hong Kong consisted of about 4 old planes, 2 Walrus planes and 2 Wildebeest torpedo bombers. And of course they were not available at all to us, as they were wiped out early morning of 8th of December in the first air raid over Hong Kong when the war came. Unexpected. When the alarm rang, when the air raid rang, went off, everybody thought it was a drill, a purpose, until bombs began to fall. They bombed.
Yes, I will ask you about the, I'm going to ask you about the opening of the war later. But it's interesting knowing what sort of defences there were. The other thing, Arthur, was there much in the way of building pillboxes?
Pillboxes. Yes. there was prior to the arrival of the Canadians to Hong Kong, many years before, maybe 34, 36, they had built a defensive line after the style of the Maginot Line, which was called the Gin Drinkers Line. It extended from Gin Drinkers Bay across up to Devil's Peak, with a strong point being at over Shin Mun Reservoir, which was called the Redoubt. It was manned by one platoon of the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Scots. And it was an impossible task for one platoon to hold back a Japanese attack in battalion strength. So the redoubt could not last. It fell. Continue. The men fought valiantly and retreated up the Indians, particularly, they retreated up to a point called Devil's Peak. And while the Royal Scots fell back on Golden Hill and then into Shamshipu Kowloon, and they came to Kai Tak. The volunteers were operating, number one company, they were operating the armored cars, the Hong Kong wanted armored cars with machine guns. And they were very effective.
Yes, I'm going to ask you more about that later, but I want to take the sort of it in chronological order, if that's all right. But these pillboxes that had been prepared, these pillboxes, and I expect with your training, you went in them, did you? What were they supplied with? What did they have inside?
Oh, these pillboxes ranged in sizes, they were of various sizes. Our pillbox had only accommodated about 15 men inside. It was just a cement box with a turret for machine gun, the two machine guns, and nothing else. No water, no toilet facilities, nothing at all. There, with pillboxes, as they're called, were not all very strongly built. They were built with blocks, cement blocks, and some of the cement blocks were not of the standard quality, so that they didn't stand up to much of the bombardment, particularly the accurate bombardment of the enemy. This cement, because of a certain scandal, were called Mimi blocks.
Mimi?
M-I-M-I, the lady. Mimi being the name of the young lady of the in charge of the contracting company, who was instrumental in getting the contracts.
And did you have adequate artillery, would you say?
We had the mountain battery, the Indian batteries, the Royal Artillery. No, they were inadequate in that, or easily overcome. We had batteries, 9-inch guns up at Mount Davis and at Stanley, Fort Stanley, and Limoon. These forts were neutralized by the Japanese Air Force. The first to go was Belchers in the west, Kennedy Town. They just bombed it out of existence and set the whole town, what we call Kennedy Town area, on fire with incendiaries. Lai Ming was the first to also to go, because that was the landing point of the enemy. There is a story connected with Lai Ming, because in, I think it was 37, when there was a very severe storm, and the Japanese passenger ship, the Asama Maru, was alongside Taikoo Shipyard, that is in Hong Kong, where Taikoo Shen is now, near Lai Moon Pass. This ship, Asama Maru, was washed ashore at Lai Moon. And the local shipyards were not able to salvage the ship. So the Admiralty allowed the Japanese to come and salvage their own ship. They took months and months to do it. They did for two reasons, for reasons obvious to us now. They could map up Lai Moon and plan on, you know, all the fortifications of Lai Moon, because they were there for a very long time, for 6 months or more, to remove the ship, because they removed all the heavy items, even the davits, the engines and everything. They sealed up all the holes in the hull, and then they had to wait for the highest tide of the year so that they could launch her out. And they were successful, both in launching the, getting the ship out, and in getting all the information about Lai Moon, which we suspect. The British were very light-hearted in connection with the Japanese espionage in Hong Kong. As an example, there was a cluster of Japanese business interests along Wynnum Street in Hong Kong, in one of the areas. And of course, this area was referred to by the British as Spy Alley. It is of note that after the capitulation of Hong Kong, some of these Japanese people, well known to us in Hong Kong, appeared in Japanese military uniform as interpreters or officers of the Japanese army.
And you saw that yourself, did you, Arthur? You knew people yourself?
No, I did not see these people. But Yamazaki, the dentist, is so well known to everybody.
What was the view of the Japanese before they attacked? Were they held in with respect, if you like, about their fighting capabilities, or were they disregarded? What did people think? What did you think of the Japanese?
We did not hold much regard or respect for the Japanese war capacity. We thought of their rifles as pretty poor implements of war. They had just small rifle, high velocity, 22 ammunition. And then when the war, we realized that if you had the however small a bullet, if you had it in you, you were out or kid dead. And you can carry more ammunition than we can carry. Ours is the 303. And if you carry 20, you weigh as a ton. And we only had about 20 rounds. Our bandolier was very heavy. So they were that advantage. They had this trench. They had mortars, which we only had a few, but they had them. They had about 6,000 or 8,000 artillery pieces. From statistics in my friend's book, who had gone to obtain, the Japanese were very statistically minded, and they had cataloged a number of shells they used in the attack in Hong Kong, the number of bombs they dropped in Hong Kong. They actually dropped 2,740 bombs in Hong Kong. And they probably expended something like 60,000 to 80,000 shells.
So really, you had underestimated them?
Completely underestimated. And their firepower, the accuracy of the artillery and bombing, and their fighting capacity at night, and even by day, the tattered uniform, which was we were so disrespectful of, were really ideal for fighting because they were perfect camouflage. You couldn't see them 10 yards away. They could stick little shrubs on the uniform would make the fetters get little holes and black button holes or loops, cotton loops that they could stick glass into. They had nets with the tin hats and they put glass into it so that they were almost invisible on the hillside. And of course, there were so many of them.
When the preparations started for war, how many hospitals were there? Were there many hospitals on the island or Kowloon?
The British had already planned, but not known to us, for hospitals. The university, all the schools were converted into temporary hospitals during the war. Nassau College, St. George's College, Hong Kong University, all these places were used for hospitals. And you have the famous or infamous case of St. Stephen's College, which was a hospital. And when the Japanese had been to the sick in bed, raped and murdered all the nurses and the doctors, or almost all. Only a few survived to tell the tale.
Did you hear about that at the time, Arthur?
I did not hear of it at the time until afterwards.
When you were in camp?
Yes.
Right. Well, I think now I'm going to get on to the war. And what, you know, we're very interested in your own story, what you yourself experienced. So could you take me to the days, you know, the sort of 6th of December, the 7th of December, which would be the Saturday and the Sunday? Can you remember that weekend and what you were doing?
5th and 6th of December. Yes, as I said, the volunteer camp undercover canvas on the hillsides of Fan Ling, facing the Japanese. We were carrying our dummy machine guns, which were for drill purposes and had no firing pins, and we had no ammunition at all. We were putting our guns out and practice our usual maneuvers. Our maneuver were fighting a retreating action. When the machine guns leapfrog each other backwards to provide covering fire for the retreat. And some people were very sarcastic, say, why do we always prepare for a practice a retreat and never an attack? And the Middlesex officer, Captain Mann, Mickey Mann, of the Middlesex Regiment, who would attach the volunteers, smiled and told us that when you attack, it's the same as you retreat. And of course, if we retreat, we go back to town, it's shorter. A very tactful answer.
So you were training that weekend?
And so we carry on for fix. But on the night of the 6th, something happened. I think it was around the 6th. And Royal Ordnance Corps trucks appeared at Fan Ling Camp in the middle of the night, about 2 to 3 a.m., with machine guns. These were guns were in boxes packed in grease. And we had under hurricane lamps under canvas to prepare these guns for action. We had to wash off the grease and prepare the guns for firing. And the rest of the machine gun team and the rest of the company were engaged in filling belt with bullets by hand. There were no machine. And I think there were about 250 rounds to each belt in the belt box. And it was difficult because these belts are brand new and they were very tight. So there's a little gadget to force the hole and then insert the bullet. And you want to make sure that it is not too tight, otherwise you get the gun will jam when you're firing. So we did that, and it was dawn when we had all our guns ready and most of the and some of the ammo ready. And the trucks took us to our forward positions that we had previously planned during the daytime, those first few days, and we mounted the guns there. And we felt, we were told to just come back, just leave the guns there. Of course, the regulars were around, and they took over.
What position was that, Arthur? What position would that have been?
It was the area around Kong Hill in Fan Ling, but the new territories has changed so much that I won't be able to find that site at all today.
But it was definitely on the mainland.
It was just about less than a mile away from the frontier.
So would that have been on the what you describe as being the gin drinkers line?
No, the gin drinkers are right back.
That's
right
further back.
The gin drinkers line is just behind Lion Rock Tunnel, the Lion Rock.
So that would have been the very forward position.
Yes.
Where the guns
very
were
forward.
Put. Yes, what did you do after that, you know, having left the guns there?
Well, it was in the afternoon then, and we ambushed, and we told them the camp was over, and we'll come back to town. And when we reached town, the whole city was abuzz with rumors and excitement and fears. Communities all gathered in their own groups, and being Portuguese, I went to Club Recreo, Club de Recreo in Kings Park. The club still standing there today in Gascoigne Road. We went there because this club had a big cricket ground so that we could many people could assemble there. We all assembled there and start talking, and everybody said, is war coming or not, you know? Some were optimistic, some were scared. But the consensus was that if anything happened, we would evacuate to Hong Kong. Just prepare back and go to Hong Kong and go to Club Lusitano, which was in Ice House Street. And we left the club and came home very disturbed, very, very disturbed. But we were all very tired after our day's excitement and having woken up at early, very early hours. So I went to bed on the 7th. In the morning of the 8th, I didn't know anything until my wife had gone to church. The 8th of December was a day of obligation for the Catholics, and she didn't wake me up. She knew that I was very tired, and she had gone to church. And on our way home, the bombing had occurred, and people told her, get home quick, rush home quick. The Japanese are bombing Hong Kong. She came home very excited to tell me, but just then the telephone rang, and I got a call from the volunteer headquarters that the volunteers are mobilized and to report to our battle position station headquarters right away. So I got back into my dirty uniform, carried my kickback, put my tin hat, pick up my rifle, kissed my wife goodbye, and I left her at home. We were staying in a flat in Ashley Road, Kowloon.
How long had you been married, Arthur?
I married on the 5th of May, 1940.
So you were newly wed, really?
Yes.
That must have been a bad moment for you, leaving your wife, was it?
Yes, but we were sort of numbed with if our thinking was... We weren't thinking, though. We had to go, and we just went, you know. She just said goodbye to me, as though I'm going to come back at 5 o'clock. I went back, reported the HQ, got on that truck, and went to my pillbox at the foot of Mount Davis.
Mount Davis?
Yeah, foot of Mount Davis.
What part of the island is that on?
Near Popfulham area.
That is on Hong Kong Island?
Hong Kong Island, facing south, on the southward side. During the war, that's later on.
That was, so you had the Winnipeg Grenadiers on your...
Yes.
On the south,
right.
And the Punjabis to the right of you.
That's right, we're there.
Yes. You're just really to the west of Victoria, aren't you?
That's right.
Yes, Mount Davis.
The Japanese had occupied an island, Lama Island, and they made a failed attack in this area of Hong Kong. And they were wiped out.
But
this was actually a way of forcing the British to put the troops all around Hong Kong.
I see.
Because they knew we only had 10,000 men, so and we couldn't concentrate our troops. We could only have 2,000 here and 2,000 there, and they would attack in battalion strength.
Yes, I can understand the weakness of that, yes. You know, being... But going back to your... When you took up your position,
yes.
This would have been on the 8th, would it? You went over to Hong Kong, yes. On the 8th of December.
On the 8th of December.
The first day of the war.
That's right.
Yes. And what did you do then, Arthur? Because the attack was mainly in the New Territories then, wasn't it? Yes. So what did you experience yourself on the 8th? What did you hear and see?
I can't remember. We were excited. We got into our pillbox and we found that there was no accommodation at all for us. No, there was no toilet facilities, no water. We had to go to a house nearby, as near for water, fill our water bottles, where the spring. And the toilet, a roll of toilet paper, that was our sanitary facilities. And the army truck came along with food for us and water. We filled our water bottles. Or the water bottle we filled from the houses nearby. They got some food for us and let our food there. And the planes came over. They systematically reduced all our resistance capabilities. A very good anti-aircraft battery. They silenced that on the 7th, around the silence, not Davis, on the 17th of December. I must say that it was on the 11th of December, after they had overrun Kowloon, they came with a flag of truce. On the 12th of December. They came with a flag of truce and offered to us to surrender. Our commander-in-chief, Sir Mark Young, the governor, who had received instructions from London, turned down the offer of surrender.
Did you hear about that yourself?
Yes, we did.
Yes. What did you think? Did you think you should surrender?
Yes, we thought that, no, we thought we should. He did the right thing.
You wanted to fight on?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, you thought there was enough. At that time, we did not fully appreciate the fact of Dunkirk, the loss of the American fleet, and the sinking of the Prince of Wales in the Navy, which happened on the 10th of December. On the 8th of December, the American fleet was destroyed. On the 10th of December, powerful British ships were sunk. So that's why on the 11th, they offered, on the 12th, they offered us to run the terms, unconditional, of course.
Was that a great blow when you heard about the Prince of Wales and the other ship?
Fortunately, I didn't hear of it until later. We thought we got the window open.
You sounded very confident. Yes. Were you confident?
We
you were young?
Very confident. Yes. Those who were not confident did not survive. They didn't have the morale. They died. Some people just give up hope. And when you give up hope, you give up life.